Church music is the topic today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we'll discuss composing hymns with Pastor Wilfred Karsten of Holy Cross Lutheran in Moline. Garrison Keillor follows with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. I'm accustomed to singing hymns, but composing them, that's a step beyond. How did you happen to do this?
I've been a pastor for 33 years, and every week pastors write sermons, and every week pastors also pick out hymns to go with the service. I'm a pastor who follows a lectionary, so through the years I've used not only the historic one-year lectionary, but also the three-year lectionary that came to us in the latter part of the 20th century. And through the years, hymns have developed that support the lectionary. In Reformation times, they were called Kirchenlieder, the core hymns. And with the historic one-year series, the same hymn was sung every Sunday of a particular church year. But as the lectionary developed then, there was an explosion of hymnody and hymnals in the 1970s, and there was a need for more hymns to be made. So as I was a pastor, after I got through those first early years and sermon writing became a little easier and less time-consuming, I thought, I need something to go along with these sermons. Sometimes with the three-year lectionary, the historic hymns that had been handed down to us through the centuries didn't always fit. We had a broader range of scripture to interpret. So I like to look at a hymn as a sermon in song. A lot of the great hymn writers through the centuries have been pastors, so I guess it's not unusual in my vocation to write hymns, hymn texts.
Do you do the words and music?
No. I'm a text writer. Mm-hmm. I'm a musician. I play the organ and the trombone, but I've never been into a composition. So,
Have you tried?
I've tried.
I cannot do it. But it just amazes me that somebody can do it. I don't know where that music comes from.
Well, the hymn text.
The
tunes.
The music, yeah.
The tunes. Well, it's through history, there have always been remarkable partnerships. Luther, as long as we're talking about the Reformation, Luther was unique in the sense that a few of his hymns were, he wrote the text and the tune. But as time developed, Luther would use his friend Johann Walther, the cantor at Torgau, to write the hymns, and same thing in later eras with Paul Gerhardt and his
hymn
writers.
Wasn't it Luther that said the devil has all the good tunes?
That's a myth.
Is it really?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a myth also that Luther got his tunes from the bar room.
Right.
his tunes were bar form. Bar form is a musical skeleton in a way, AAB. That's bar form. Like a mighty fortress is our God.
Right.
The same rhyming scheme is used in the first two verses of the stanza.
You know, that's interesting because the Great American Songbook is built on a scheme, AABA.
Mm-hmm.
You get one phrase and then you repeat it. Then you do kind of a bridge, that's the BA, and then you go back to the first tune with different lyrics, AABA. If you get that first section, then you've got your song.
Yeah.
And some of the great songs are just simple AABA forms. And people don't think about structural form, but you need it if you're going to build something.
You do indeed, Mr. Wooten, and that's my starting point usually. I'll get a kernel of a thought, And for instance, 2 weeks ago, the reading in our lectionary, and I think the reading in the lectionary of most Christian churches, was the feeding of the 5,000. And I've preached on that text, I don't know, dozens of times, maybe. But it occurred to me that I wanted to emphasize the abundance, 12 baskets of leftovers, of surplus was gathered afterwards. So that was the germ of my thought, and it developed into the phrase, your generous blessings you lavish on me. And so you figure out how many syllables that is and fit it into the rhyme scheme, and that's how I start.
So then you look for a tune that
I do.
Fits it's, that, or does a tune ever give you an idea?
It does, and I never write a text without a tune in mind. But, you know, in this day of internet, you can go to hymnary.org and and type in the meter, and you got hundreds of tunes. One I'm just finishing, I was doing 7676D, which is like to the church's one foundation. And that didn't fit the tone of what I was writing, so I wanted another tune in my head. So I found an old Irish tune from the 1600s, and that really helped me make the text. Now, on my Reformation hymn, for instance, this contest that I entered was solely for a text. They had commissioned a prominent composer. When they named the winner, they would give the text to the composer, and he would compose a new tune. So I needed to have something in my head as I wrote my text to submit for the contest. So people do realize that after the Reformation, during the Reformation, in the 1520s, 1523, when the first Protestant hymnal was published with 8 hymns in it, there was an explosion of hymnody, hymn text, because the hymns were used as a teaching tool, but the tunes didn't always follow. So they duplicated a lot of tunes. For instance, the German tune Nun freut euch was used for several different texts in the first hymnal that only had 8 hymns in it. So when I developed my Reformation hymn, I wanted to use a Reformation meter. And look, I have a collection of 300-some hymnals, so it's easy to do a little research and find out what was written in the 1500s, what meter they used. They used the meter 8-7-8-7-8-8-7, and I found that was the perfect meter for the Reformation hymn I wrote.
You know, it's interesting. Our national anthem takes its melody from a bar song, well, a drinking song, to Anacreon in Heaven. I actually have a recording of that, the original drinking song,
okay,
from which the Star Spangled Banner was drawn.
I lived in Maryland for 22 years and got down to Fort McHenry every once in a while. So,
could you read the text of your hymn or give us a sample anyway?
Okay, this is called Though All Art.
And you entered a contest. How did it do?
I was the winner.
Yeah.
Whoa. All right.
So I've...
Now, will this be distributed to...
Or has the melody been
Was this
written?
A Lutheran contest or just a...
Well, it was open to all people around the world. I think there were 260-some submissions from 3 or 4 different continents.
But will it get distributed now to churches?
It's yes. Okay. It was a composition was made. I've relinquished my rights to it.
Okay.
So Concordia Publishing House in St. Louis now owns it. The composer was Jeffrey Blursch from Concordia University in Nebraska.
Read the text. Too.
Okay. Though all our life is like a scroll, unrolled with blemished pages, though sin has shredded what was whole, and death is now our wages, yet here we stand in confidence with Jesus as our sole defense, for he alone still saves us. So the Reformation principles of Luther were... Mm-hmm. Grace alone,
right.
Faith alone, and Scripture alone. We call those the Reformation solas. But there were really two more. And There was a solus Christus, Christ alone. And so I incorporated that into the first stanza, and then I built around grace, faith, and the word. And then the final stanza, which was what Bach always picked up on, was soli Deo gloria, to God be the glory. So I developed a doxological stanza, praise to Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in the fifth stanza. The fifth stanza, now sing a high doxology to God who gives salvation. Both here and in eternity, let this be our vocation. To Father, Son, and Spirit raise a symphony of grateful praise, for He alone is worthy. Actually, I think I came home from a QCSO concert and finished that last stanza. I was going to say a melody of grateful praise, but it seemed to me that a symphony of grateful praise was more vivid. In hymn writing, you need to avoid empty words, words that are just filler and serve no purpose. But the converse of that is that you use words that are not just ordinary, but have more meaning. So that's how symphony got in there instead of melody. They both would have worked structurally because they're three syllables, but... hymn writing is kind of fun. It's like a...
Symphony is a better choice. You obviously are really into this.
I am.
And it wasn't fair to the other contestants. But the fact that you have this tremendous collection of hymns, and you obviously are deeply into it, and you also play the organ, you say.
I do, although my wife is the organist at our church, so...
Do you ever sneak into the church on your own?
I do. I try and practice on Tuesday mornings, but the duties of the pastoral ministry call me away from it. I was an organist before I was a pastor. But
what led you to serve as a minister?
I grew up in a Christian devoted family, and I think that's the essence of it. And
Where did you attend seminary?
Concordia St. Louis.
And how many different places have you been a pastor?
Just two. I grew up in Iowa, and my first call, I asked to be west of the Mississippi River, and in our system, you're placed by a placement committee after you graduate from the seminary. And so on call night, I was placed in Accident, Maryland, and I thought, if this is west of the Mississippi, it's a long trip to get there. But it was a blessing. And we stayed there for 22 years. And then in February of 2006, I got the call to be pastor of Holy Cross, and I've been there ever since. So I'm in the last decade of my ministry, but I've only had two different congregations.
That's a bit unusual, isn't it?
I would say so, but I'm a farm boy from Iowa, the fifth generation on the same family farm, so I was never used to moving. So I knew when I wanted to be a pastor, I would like a little stability.
Well, I tease my minister friends by saying, I like teaching better than pastoring. My congregation moves every 4 years. I can stay put. Are there particular hymn writers that you admire?
Well, Luther, of course.
Yeah, he did a pretty good job.
Paul Gerhardt. Just because of his abundance of hymns, and most of his hymns were, on his tombstone it says, a theologian sieved in the crucible of suffering or something like that. His hymns really speak of life. That was a kind of a turn in the 17th century when hymn writing went more objective to subjective.
Now, you already destroyed one myth by telling me that Luther didn't say the devil has all the good tunes. Don't tell me that he didn't write Away in a Manger.
No, he didn't. That's true. This has been researched, and the first edition of that was published in Pennsylvania.
Is that right?
Luther's cradle hymn is actually Vom Himmel Hoch, From heaven above to earth I come.
Okay.
To bear good news to every home. So, yeah, we'd like
Well,
to,
I do have a text in which it says attributed to Luther.
Well, yes.
But
that,
it isn't.
That A-T-R, you got to look for them at the bottom of a hymnal, just like the word, the initial A-L-T. That means it's altered. And so attributed and altered are two naughty words in a hymnal.
You know, there's a pastor who would write little verses and send them as Christmas cards.
Mm-hmm.
And his son changed them into hymns, and they're some of the finest hymns I've heard. The son's name was Alfred Burt. He was a trumpet player.
Ah.
And I think it's the Boston Pops on one of their recordings has this little collection of his hymns. And they're just beautiful. And I thought, well, people are still writing hymns. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and most hymns, you know, in our day and age now, in some churches, put things up on the screen and the wall. You know, hymns, we don't know if hymnals are going to be a thing of the past. But in every generation, there's always new hymns, but very few survive to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that somehow it's not just the person and it's not just the theology. It's the age itself. That, I mean, you can kind of tell a 19th century hymn mm-hmm. and a contemporary hymn, and mm-hmm. I mean, they're not the same, right?
But I don't know. I think the pastor's hymn would fit right back into the classical category.
Well, in the 1980s, there was this movement, and I'm a member of the Hymn Society in America and in the U.S., so I try to keep up on these things.
Right.
The hymnals that came out in the 70s and 80s across the broad range of denominations wanted to do updating of languages. So instead of "My faith looks up to thee," it became "My faith looks up to you." And people didn't like that.
No. Yeah.
So the more recent hymnals in late 20th century, early 21st century, went back to down-dating language and went back to the original text. So that's why when you see ALT altered at the bottom, that means something.
Well, as we look forward to the anniversary of the Reformation, you have a Reformation hymn, and our congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
Pastor Wilfred Carsons of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Moline has been our guest today. And the next fellow in front of a microphone is going to be Garrison Keeler. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. I wonder how you'd relate hymn writing to poetry.
It's sort of one and the same thing, I think. You do the same thing in hymn writing. Poetry itself almost has a kind of chant to it if it's done well.
Well, actually,
I mean, you can say da 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 da, but if you read poetry the way it's done, and if you listen to a good hymn, the two supplement each other.
Well, you know, music is built into the human voice. You cannot express meaning in language without your voice rising and falling, a little louder here, a little softer there. Speeded up, slowed down, all those things are musical elements in the human voice.
Well, William Blake, the poet of Songs of Innocence, has the opening poem about the little lamb on a cloud has an interesting progression in which he places the arts. The lamb appears to the piper who's piping a song in a meadow, and the lamb says, "Sing a song." Or no, plays his music. So he plays his pipes, and the lamb, who is also Jesus, weeps to hear. And then the piper says, "Sing a song." That is, add words.
Uh-huh.
And then as he sings the song, the lamb begins to disappear. And then the lamb says, finally, "Get a book and write them down." And we'll turn them into poetry. So from music to song to poetry, each one is one step down. And at the moment he begins to write, the inspiration or the lamb or Jesus disappears. But the advantage is everybody can read it.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's the hierarchy. Singing is one step below music, pure music, but it's one step above poetry.
Well, I don't know that I would buy that exact gradation, but to me, they all kind of flow together. And back in the early days in Broadway, if you look at the lyrics of Otto Harbach, they're all little poems. Every little movement has a meaning all its own. Every thought and feeling and some posture can be shown. And just lovely little poems. And the music is just beautiful that goes with it. Quite often, you know, there's some kind of rhyme, but you don't see the highly structured lyrics now that we used to have in popular music.
Well, nor do you in contemporary church music.
That's true.
I mean, it's, you know, I grew up on the old hymns, and I still miss the ones we don't sing anymore.
I wonder why things go in and out of fashion. You back in the Catholic Church before it, when we had the Latin Rite, the hymns were always the same, but they were beautiful. You know, we just sing them over and over and over again. But in all churches, music is an important element. I believe. Am I missing some churches, some denominations that don't like music?
Well, the Puritans did not allow instruments in their church. But they did have singing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but they forbid instruments. And I think aside from the organ and the piano, it wasn't very much thought of in the church I grew up in either. You know, you didn't have a flute player or a cello come in and play, right? And you certainly didn't play the saxophone because that was the devil's instrument.
Well, the devil has all the good tunes.
I was not allowed to take the saxophone as my instrument.
Did you have a great desire to play the saxophone?
I would like to have, but I ended up playing the clarinet instead, which was acceptable.
Well, it's acceptable because I think it's because it's more difficult. I talked many times about the great thing about the saxophone is how easy it is to change octaves. But on the clarinet, that's not a simple thing. You go through an octave and a half, and then you have to come back.
Right.
Another. Yeah. So you took the harder path.
Well, thank you. It was not my intention, but my mother was adamant.
Well, were you ever any good at it?
No. Everything I was in, you know, and that was when we went to contests and stuff, and I would play in a quartet or a duet or a solo. It was always... Well, the second clarinet was a little loud.
Well, I played clarinet in the South Memphis Park Band, and I was so good they had me carry the flag in the parade. With that, we'll fade out of here, parade out of the studio. And for Roll Tweet, I'm Don Wooten. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week on Scribble.